In his new book, Gilded Rage, independent journalist and New York Times bestselling author Jacob Silverman delivers a searing expose on the radicalization of Silicon Valley, a peek behind the curtain at the tech and finance billionaires who are using their money and influence to steer a radical political revolution. As he follows men like Elon Musk and Peter Thiel from early days of PayPal and Palo Alto to Washington, D.C., Silverman uncovers a sinister world where moguls preach populist revolt while dismantling the few remaining checks on their influence. This is the book you need to understand our current political moment and how tech and politics have become dangerously intertwined. Gilded Rage is available October 7th from Bloomsbury Continuum. Get your copy wherever books are sold.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. This podcast is sponsored by The Nation magazine. I'm Jeet here. I'm a national affairs correspondent with The Nation. And this week I have a colleague from The Nation. He's Chris Lehman, who's the DC bureau chief. And we're going to be talking about the latest antics of those clowns in Washington, which I think is actually a phrase that's perhaps more relevant now than ever. You know, there's a government shutdown, as there has recurringly been for the last few decades. And there's the usual sort of blame game. And perhaps the one thing maybe different about this shutdown, this is the first really fully social media government shutdown. So I want to, first of all, welcome Chris to the program.
Thanks, Jeet. Always a pleasure.
So yeah, let's just talk about, like, broadly, you know, what is this shutdown? Why is it happening? And then we can go into the way the parties are positioning themselves.
Well, the sort of, you know, bigger picture explanation of why this is happening is the explanation of why a lot of stuff in Washington is happening, which is that Congress has just ceased to function altogether. There's, you know, normally an appropriations process whereby the Appropriations Committee in both the House and Senate drafts spending bills for 12 different arms of the government. And that process, due to, again, dysfunction and polarization in Congress, has not been used, I don't know, for at least a decade, it seems like. And so what we have instead is this panicked seat of the pants process whereby Congress approves what's called a continuing resolution to just continue funding the government, and they defer larger decisions about appropriation spending basically indefinitely under the system. And so what happens then is you have, you know, boondoggles like the recently passed, quote, big, beautiful bill, you know, sort of become the de facto blueprints. And we're also in this moment where, you know, the Supreme Court just recently approved the Trump administration doing what's called a rescission of $4 billion in foreign aid spending. There's a massive, and predictably the political press doesn't really cover this at all, but there's a massive amount of money that's simply unaccounted for. It could be going into crypto. It could be going into, you know, Barron Trump's, you know, I don't know. So what we have is a situation now is a little different in that the Democrats actually refused to do what they did the last time this set of conditions turned up in March, when Chuck Schumer, you know, folded like a cheap suit and basically said, we're not going to obstruct the funding of government. What we're doing is we're going to wait until Trump is politically weaker. And, you know, this is why we need different Democratic leadership, which is a different subject, I guess. But Schumer's theory of the case at the time was Trump will be weaker in the fall, and we will peel off 4 or 5 Senate appropriators to do the right thing. And, you know, to see that basic government services are funded, like these ACA tax credits, which are the sticking point right now. You know, these are vital subventions to, you know, what is otherwise an out of control healthcare system. And in many cases, you know, families making like, I think around $85,000 a year in annual income will see their premiums triple. You know, and this is under broad conditions of inflation and what's looking like stagflation in the labor economy. So this is really going to hurt a lot of people. And I think even Democrats who are very conflict averse and very uncreative in their congressional strategy have sort of recognized under pressure from the Democratic base, it should be stressed, that this is a bright line that they can't cave in on. And, you know, I think, as I think you know, both you and I are rare to praise the existing Democratic Party.
Yeah.
But I think strategically, this is proving to be a pretty, at least for now, a sound decision. Polling shows to a striking degree that the American public is blaming the Republicans for the shutdown, even though, you know, by the traditional Beltway math, it's the Democrats who are provoking it. I think in part that's because the Republicans control everything right now. Yeah. And you know, people are wondering just what the Democratic Party is doing. But in this instance, they have done something. And I think, especially given the kind of, I don't even know how to describe it, the manic ethos of mismanagement from the Trump White House over all this. You know, I think that Democrats are coming off looking like, you know, the reasonable party that wants to do something. And Republicans are just freaking out in just, you know, scattershot fashion. There was, you know, originally this whole wave of rhetoric that I wrote about how, you know, the conspiracy theory on the right was that Democrats are trying to extend these ACA benefits to undocumented immigrants because that, you know, this is another conspiracy theory on the right that's also BS, that undocumented immigrants are a kind of
voting block.
Yeah, voting block.
The fact that they can't vote.
Right, right. It's not, you know, if you accept the conspiratorial premise here, it's the dumbest way for Democrats to erect a conspiracy because these people overwhelmingly are not allowed to vote. And they also, by the way, do not qualify for these ACA benefits. So it is all a lie, literally. And now, you know, Trump is now pivoting to say, well, this is great. The Democrats have given us this cudgel. We're going to hammer away at the administrative state. Russ Vought is going to dismiss hundreds of thousands or thousands, at least, of federal workers and, quote, Democrat agencies. None of that's legal, which hasn't really stopped Trump before. But it is, I think, not going to play to the image of, you know, Republicans as honest brokers.
I mean, there's a couple of things to sort of like unpack there, which is one reason is that, yeah, the initial response of the Republicans to defend their position was this kind of lie, and also like a racist lie. I mean, they, you know, Trump.
Oh, yes. Do you want to talk about the video here?
Yeah, the video. Yeah, no, but I think, yeah, before we get to like, you know, the exact nature of this racist lie, I think it's worth unpacking the fact that they need this lie because the actual policy issue at dispute, the extension of the ACA, is like overwhelmingly popular. Like I think you cited this sort of Kaiser poll, which was like, you know, 92% of Democrats, 82% of independents, and even 57% of Republicans want the ACA extended, which I mean, one understands that this is like, you know, as you mentioned, a policy that will affect like, you know, broad swath of middle class Americans and like, you know, drive up what is already far too high their like healthcare costs, then it's easy to understand like it's a politically reckless and foolish thing for the Republicans to do to make this the issue. And the only way they can get around this fundamental political problem is to then recast this as a lie. It's not like the Democrats are fighting to extend the ACA. They're fighting to give healthcare benefits to undocumented immigrants. So it's a kind of necessary lie. But beyond this, that sort of political logic, you know, there's the extra special sauce of, you know, Trumpian racism. But do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, no, I mean, was sort of a perfect little set piece, because on Monday, after Trump had previously canceled a planned meeting with congressional leaders about reaching an agreement on funding the government, he did finally meet with Hakeem Jeffries and Chuck Schumer, in addition to the Republican leadership in Congress. And it kind of said everything about the current state of our government, which is to say, you know, Chuck Schumer dutifully afterwards gave an interview where he said he really thought that for the first time, Trump understood the gravity of the crisis. And then literally just, I don't know, 3 or 4 hours later, Trump posted this deranged video that some other MAGA person had created with AI that shows Schumer saying, basically, everyone hates the Democrats. The only way we can get forward is to do woke trans policies and recruit, again, undocumented immigrants in this sort of new industrial army of voters. And it was quite racist in that, I mean, it was racist in a way that only makes sense in the MAGA brain, I guess, because Hakeem Jeffries doesn't speak in the video, but he is wearing a giant sombrero, which is just like all brown people can be crammed into some meme here, I guess, and has a fake mustache, which I was trying to dope out. So they're actually suggesting that Hakeem Jeffries himself is an undocumented immigrant, I guess. Anything is possible, I suppose. But it was just, you know, kind of stunning to see in the wake of this sort of kabuki meeting where, you know, Chuck Schumer is trying to look like he's doing sober negotiations with a person who is a demented racist. I mean, there's, you know, this is the whole problem of centrism in this moment. Like, you know, what is the centrist strategy in concrete terms? Is it to, you know, dismantle the administrative state more gently? Like there's no, you know, there.
I know. I mean, that is actually a good sort of question. I mean, I will mention, since you said that, I had reviewed last week Kamala Harris's new autobiography. And there's one passage I should quote it in my review, but it was very striking, where she's, you know, like towards the end of the book, is sort of looking into the future and saying, you know, well, how are we going to rebuild after, you know, all the things that Trump has done? And she says, you know, well, it could be that there's an opportunity here that we can rebuild a government that is like leaner, more efficient. And so basically what you're saying is that Doge and all the stuff is actually like, you know, yeah, you will just do it better. You will like take the opportunity that Trump and Musk will have dismantled the actually existing American welfare state, and that you will then create a new neoliberal state. And so, I mean, if that's your alternative, then you're basically saying you're two wings of the same party. I mean, like what are you even saying there? But in any case, so I think that speaks directly to what you're saying. Like, what exactly is the strategy here? But yeah, I mean, I think there's also this other question. Yeah, I mean, you want to show you're the grown up and you can negotiate and, you know, meet with the president. And that's what Schumer and Jeffries are saying. Like, we just want to have a meeting. We just want to, you know, but then Trump does this other stuff showing that, you know, on their end, there's not a lot of interest in negotiations. I mean, like, you don't put a video like that out if your goal is to negotiate with the other side in good faith. No,
obviously. Right. And again, we're seeing now in the iteration of, you know, the threatened, what I'm calling the botpocalypse for the federal workforce. Like, you know, the GOP strategy, you know, there's no mystery here. It's Project 2025, with which Russell Bott presided over. And it is, to, you know, reduce the federal government to, as Grover Norquist famously put it, to the size where you can drown it in a bathtub. And to what that means in sort of practical, it's interesting because in macroeconomic terms, the federal state has been hollowed out so much over the past 50 years that it's unclear what the impact on say the overall job market, which is softening anyway, will be. But in terms of, you know, these basic things like the ACA tax credits, you know, these are really going to hurt people. I think, you know, what the other thing people don't realize is only about 17% of the federal workforce is concentrated in and around Washington. So if you start, you know, getting rid of agencies, as Vaad is suggesting, you're going to really hurt people in red states, which is what they think of in MAGA mythology as, you know, the real America, who's going to turn out again and again to support Trump. But this is really a huge unforced error on the part of, you know, a right-wing government that, you know, in theory should be catering to its constituents. But, you know, that's the other big problem is both major parties don't really have clear coalitions. You know, the Trump coalition in 2024 is already collapsing. And, you know, the Democrats, ever since they basically decided to scuttle the labor movement as the bedrock of their coalition, you know, are basically the professional managerial class who, I mean, that's in my sort of vulgar Marxist view is, you know, why the party is so slow and listless in these fights is the people who are most represented in the Democratic Party aren't getting it in the neck the way that middle class and working class Americans are. They're pretty privileged. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's true about both parties. And in terms of what we were just talking about, in terms of like this turn towards Vought, and I mean, that's the other big meme that's come out of it. Right. It just came out in we're recording this on Friday morning. It was just released. If you like the sombrero hat,
you love Grim Reaper,
Mexican Hakeem Jeffries. This one is, do you want to just like briefly describe this new video? Which I have to say is like a major shift in rhetoric and in argument from what they were just arguing. Because the previous argument was, you know, we have to have this fight because these screwball Democrats want to give government funding, healthcare funding for undocumented immigrants. But now what is the argument?
Well, again, I'm going to have to fill in a lot of blanks here because it's less of an argument than a, you know, an agitprop provocation, I think. But you know, the argument, as I can suss out, is, you know, it's basically Steve Bannon's critique of what he called the administrative state and the idea that, you know, government under democratic rule has become this sort of sluice gate of corruption and deep state machinations. So, yeah, the idea is in this video, Russ Vaught is portrayed as the Grim Reaper, which I guess is a suitable Halloween theme, and is going to, you know, go after what Trump has called, quote, Democrat agencies, which is, again, a complete neologism, especially, you know, like the Department of Education was Nixon, OSHA was Nixon. I can't remember the last time Democrats created an agency. So anyway.
No. And especially since, I mean, the Republicans themselves are, you know, like actually using a lot of these agencies to pursue their own agenda. I mean, the Department of Education.
Yeah, actually, that was Carter. Now that
that was Carter. Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, certainly like that's actually become instrumental in the sort of, you know, free speech crackdown that the Republicans are doing.
Yeah, no, it is this weird moment where, you know, again, this is my broader critique of the Democrats is, you know, you have all of these opportunities right now. Like, you know, the free speech crackdown is very unpopular. Basically, everything Trump is doing, including immigration, is really unpopular right now. So in my view, Democrats could have used this moment, rare moment of leverage when they're in the minority and they can basically shut down the budget process to not only demand, you know, preserving the ACA credits, but saying like, you know, the blatantly illegal ICE raids that are happening in cities across the country stops now. The sort of federalization of local law enforcement, which is again blatantly unconstitutional, stops now. The war on universities and media companies, all that stops now. Again, you know, you're not going to get all this, but you have a megaphone, which is what the Democrats have lacked. And you have some leverage, and you can, you know, sort of, I mean, the ACA stuff is genuinely important and vital, but it is also a reflection of, you know, the Democrats' fixation on, quote, kitchen table issues, right?
That this is
how we deliver. This is how we bring independents back into the fold. This is how we win in red districts, et cetera. Some of that's true. But I think, you know, you also can actually expand the shrinking Democratic base if you say these other things.
I mean, there's a couple of things to say on that point. One of which is, I mean, if you're using this for as partially a messaging fight, which the Republicans clearly are, I mean, Trump is clearly trying to stoke up his base with first the racism and then the actually a contradictory appeal to the sort of austerity libertarian wing. But the Democrats, I mean, you're using this to, you know, messaging, but then it becomes a question like, how good are you at messaging? And I have to say, I mean, like, there has been some pretty good reporting on the fact that, you know, when Schumer and Jeffries, they're doing these live stream things that often get, you know, like 100 people or less. As compared to, like, you know, Bernie Sanders.
And AOC, video was like, you know, that is how real people talk in the world about, you know, things that matter.
Which, like, got, like, several hundred thousand, I mean, close to, like, a billion, that was the number I saw. Like, if you're actually just, I mean, if your whole point is that we have to have this healthcare message as a messaging thing to, you know, win the midterms, this is real politics, then should you actually be looking at, like, who's actually doing the successful messaging and who's messaging people actually want to watch? And, like, you know, like, I mean, the numbers of the on the Schumer, Jeffries, you know, stuff, it's like your grandmother could do recipe YouTube and will get like more people watching than like want to listen to Chuck Schumer. I mean, that is the fact.
No, it is. It is. You know, I was covering the first round of anti-Doge protests here in D.C. And, you know, there was an infamous sort of meme of Schumer trying to whip up the crowd and saying, we will fight, we will win. And people just were not buying it. You know, they've seen Chuck Schumer not do those things for too long. This is a whole, you know, a separate podcast in some ways. But, you know, the Democratic Party is starred for ideas and leaders. To have Hakeem Jeffries and Chuck Schumer as the face of the party at a moment like this where significant ground can be gained is just tragic, in my view.
Yeah, no. I mean, and it does seem like both the sort of Trump messages are potentially very damaging for Trump. I mean, I think because of the election results, Democrats have sort of started to shy away from calling out Trump's racism. And that seems very short-sighted because one of the things that one is seeing in the polling is that the big swing of Latino voters towards the Republican Party has swung basically back. And that's also showing up in the sort of special elections. And one can sort of theoretically posit that there were a lot of Latino voters, you know, who are basically unhappy about the economy, were unhappy with Joe Biden for, you know, pretty much the same reason everyone was unhappy with Joe Biden. And Kamala Harris as the, you know, promising everything that Joe Biden did, but that those voters are the swing voters and that they've turned off Trump, and they've turned off Trump partially because he hasn't fixed the economy as he did. And also, one would suspect, and I don't think this is even speculation. I mean, there's a lot of evidence of this, that the actual immigration crackdown, which is not a crackdown, you know, as was promised of like, you know, the worst of the worst, but it's actually like a crackdown of like ordinary people, many of them who have been in the U.S. for long periods of time, is very unpopular. And so Trump's like racist messaging offers a real potential to win back this crucial group of voters. And then the second part is, you know, Trump shifting from the racism to like, basically, I mean, if you're having Vought and he's the Grim Reaper and he's going to, you know, you're embracing an austerity message. And I don't think that has broad popularity either.
Right. No, I mean, that's the thing is, you know, the prevailing economic conditions call for countercyclical measures, which, you know, Trump was trying to do by leaning on the Fed to lower interest rates and all that. But now, you know, this is the thing. There's no coherence in any of this. Like, you know, one reason the job market is softening so dramatic, you know, softening, I think, is too soft a word. It's plummeting. Because, you know, Trump is targeting the backbone of the American service economy. Immigrants contribute, the GAO estimated in 2023 that over the next decade, immigrants are contributing $10 trillion to the American economy. So, and they're in sectors like healthcare, like agriculture, and, you know, which is, you know, that whole sector is also reeling from tariffs, which is a whole other issue in terms of the performance of the economy. So there are all these openings, and Democrats are just falling over themselves. You know, that one of the first things Democrats did in the new Congress was to cave on the Laken and Riley Act, which is the piece of legislation that basically authorizes a lot of these goon squad raids. And again, because they are just timorous and they're afraid of being seen as, quote, soft on immigration. But if you don't have any policy to speak of, except, you know, the orange man is bad when he does things we don't like, there's, you know, nothing for, but there's nothing to bring voters in. It's just, you know, kind of, we oppose Trump, but we're not going to do it seriously.
No.
It is not a serious opposition party.
No, not at all. I mean, you know, with the proviso, like, they are showing a little bit more backbone and
right now, and it'll be interesting.
You're trying to use the leverage that I think you and I argued it on previous occasions they could have done in budget fights, and then they deliberately shied away from. So
yeah, I mean, again, you know, let's roll the tape on what Chuck Schumer's theory of the case was in the spring. Right, he was going to bring around, I mean, two things basically. Were the prong of the strategy he described in capitulating to the Republicans in Congress. You know, one, as I mentioned, was we're going to bring around, you know, four or five Senate appropriators from the GOP. That has not happened remotely. You know, and, you know, we're now, you know, basically 10 years into the Trump capture of the GOP. You should be smarter than that. You just should be.
And Hakeem Jeffries as well. He repeatedly says, you know, like, I hope and trust that.
Right. We trust that the GOP is going to do the right thing. What GOP are you talking about? Like, it does not exist.
Where does this come from? Yeah.
And the other thing Schumer said he was going to get back, and I feel this personally because I live around D.C., is the $1 billion in the D.C. budget that the Senate took at the 11th hour of that continuing resolution fight, and that money is still gone. And meanwhile, DC has been, you know, is now an occupied city. So, there's just no, you know, when I say the Democrats are not a serious opposition party, that's what I mean. Like, they have not, you know, and I'm old, so I remember, you know, when, Reagan was elected. Democrats did have a majority, so that mattered more, but they were going hammer and tongs after this stuff. And, you know, Reagan basically, after his first disastrous tax cut blew a hole into the budget, he was forced to quietly walk a lot of it back. So, you know, there, even if you're in the minority, there are tools you can use, if nothing else, to show people that you can be trusted to oppose what are, you know, a vast body of authoritarian and fascist policies.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this actually goes back to something you had brought up earlier, which I wanted to, like, bring back into the conversation, which is the constitutional issue, like the sort of the failure of Congress and the, you know, what has seen in the sort of Trump era. But I think this also applies to some degree for Biden and Obama, is the sort of Congress, you know, becoming this, like, vestigial branch of government, and really, like, a power being done through the White House, and that the courts, you know, which should be the other check, at least under Republican administrations, are willing to give, you know, presidents, like, a wide sort of swath. And so, like, to me, but also, I mean, under Democratic administrations than cutting back on executive power. So like if that's the constitutional system as it actually exists now, that like actually, you know, although in theory Congress is the one that has the power of the purse, is supposed to vote all these appropriations, is supposed to have oversight, but is doing none of that.
And declare war, let's not forget.
Declare war. Right. Just to build on that, I mean, like, now we have seen Trump claiming that as president, he has the power to, like, just blow up ships in the hemisphere and basically be in a de facto war with Venezuela, with, I would say, like, minimal congressional at best the Democrats in Congress are saying, well, this looks like legally dodgy and we should vote on it so it can become legal, so you want to like post facto legalize
I wrote a piece for Harper's in the last issue arguing that Trump should be impeached for the Iran strikes because you know it is a it's true that the War Powers Act has almost never been honored, but this is a new level. I mean, this is just the president not bothering to inform anyone in Congress ahead of time. And again, no one in the political press is covering this, but like the ostensible aim of the Iran strike was to disable Iran's nuclear capabilities. It utterly failed. I mean, it was a disaster on its own terms. But more troublingly, of course, is, you know, you're creating a Caesarian presidency that's just going to wade into, and predictably, after there was no pushback in Iran, Trump started murdering people off the coast of Venezuela. There is absolutely no evidence, credible evidence cited anywhere that suggests these people were part of a, you know, global fentanyl smuggling network. They were likely fishermen. And in fact, some of the survivors of the people killed on these illegal raids have said as much. So
But even if they weren't like smuggling fentanyl, you're not supposed to like just blow up people because you think they might be drug dealers. Like, there's actually like, you know, we used to live in a world of laws. I mean,
it's true. But then, again, Congress needs to just act in its own self-interest. That's, you know, the whole theory of the Constitution collapses when one of the major powers of government stops acting in its own self-interest. And that is what's happening.
I'd actually say like even like two of the branches. I mean, because if you have, you know, like Congress not acting and the
The Supreme Court is acting. The Supreme Court,
for now, like greenlighting like everything, then it is like absolutely, you know, like an imperial presidency. Or even beyond that, like, you know, this is the sort of nightmare of Republican government, Caesarism. But what is then explaining like why Democrats are not pushing back on this? Because like, I can kind of think that, you know, there might be a sort of Machiavellian idea that like, well, we will get the presidency again at some point. And then we if all these powers exist, we want it for ourselves. Or is it just like a complete inability to understand like the role of Congress? Like, what is the thinking? It's for me, it's very hard. I mean, I understand the Republican logic. The Republican logic is they become the party of Trump. He's their warlord. They'll support him, do or die, even in violation of their own principles. But what is the Democratic Party thinking here?
Yeah, I mean, I think about this a lot, and of course, the day job. My reductive theory, which I think has a lot of evidence behind it, is because of this sort of, you know, the Democratic Party's drift away from the working class and the professional managerialization of the Democratic Party. They hate politics. They do not. They think politics is beneath them. They think they have the credentials to rule. They think they have the knowledge to rule. So, you know, it's annoying to them that they have to participate in mass democracy, and they don't want to. So, they look for every occasion to sidestep it. That's why, you know, speaking of Schumer and Jeffries, that's why they to this day have not endorsed Zoran Mamdani. That is, you know, that's what Democrats really feel. You know, they spend a lot more time disciplining the left wing of the party than attacking the right. It's just true. And because, you know, Mamdani represents a kind of politics that they disown and don't like. They don't want, you know, people basically saying, I will speak directly to voters. And you know what? I will actually deliver on kitchen table issues to the extent of going, you know, going after the oligarchs. You know, that the, and, you know, you alluded to this earlier, they are, you know, the major parties are both wings of the oligarchy and they're funded by the oligarchy. So, you know, historically, the Democrats have been the sort of tech wing of the American oligarchy. Now the tech industry has migrated to the right, so they don't even have that. So, yeah, they're just in this doom loop where, you know, the only way to break out of it is actually to embrace mass democracy. But they won't.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think that's a very convincing analysis. The only proviso that to some extent, even in this, you know, very decadent democracy, there has to be some responsiveness to voters. I actually do think that a lot of the anger that they've experienced at town halls and from their own voters and from polling, like, is kind of like pushing them towards an uncomfortable position.
I do think this will be an important test case because they are taking a stand. They did not, you know, sort of succumb to the first round of threats from the Republicans. You know, they said that the vote, the Russell vote, you know, Grim Reaper feint is just sort of an empty threat. So that's encouraging, right? So, but we'll see what they can build from there.
We will see. I think, you know, I did want to offer a little bit of hope, but I mean, sure. The longer term prognosis, based on your analysis, would be you need a change of the leadership, that this leadership class
minimally. Now, I'm, you know, my old writer at TNR, Uchida Nwanebu, has a new book where he basically says, you know, the way to, if you're serious about sustaining American democracy, we need a new founding. There's a lot to recommend in his argument, but again, that's another podcast.
That's a conversation for another day. Okay. So on that note, I want to thank Chris once again for being on the program, and I'll link to your article, but yes, always great talking.
Likewise. Have a good weekend.